Hi, this is Richard Hudson and
Steve Levine.
We're here with Compliance and Cocktails. This podcast today is being recorded on February 25th, 2021. We were down for a week due to the snowpocalypse of 2021, which we survived. So now we've got the Rona and the snow and the loss of power here in Texas. And we're still standing strong, so we apologize for being off for a week, but we're glad to have you back. Again, this is Compliance and Cocktails. We want this to just be a fun environment where we'll discuss the compliance issues of the day. You know, hopefully one day eventually invite leading experts in the various fields to talk about what's on their mind as well. For today, Steve and I have some thoughts about what's going on, so sit back, make a cocktail, and relax as we go through our subject. So Steve, I know you've got a lot to talk about, but let's start with the CFPB.
CFPB. Well, all I've got to tell you is you better be nice to me, because the CFPB is on a hiring frenzy, and I'm awfully tempted to put in my resume. You know, you never know. I'm sure they could find some low-level grunt work for me, you know, 30-year consumer attorney experience. I don't know that they'll count my industry experience. I don't know if it's the right kind of experience.
And Chopra's not even, he's not even, you know, had a confirmation hearing yet, and they're already ramping up under the acting director, correct?
Yes, they are. They are awfully busy. I read today that they launched their first action against the company, and not related to auto finance. But they're getting busy quickly.
Thankfully, but that's a start, right?
Yeah, they're getting busy quickly, and this hiring ramp, I mean, we're laughing about it, but it shows you where they're going. I mean, they expect to canvas companies, that they're going to send a lot of examiners out there. I won't be one of them. I'm only being facetious. Heck, anybody that knows me, you know, I wouldn't last 5 minutes in that structured environment. Shoot, Richard has me sitting here drinking a rum and Diet Coke in the middle of an afternoon recording a podcast. I don't think I'd fit very well.
Now, that acting director, you got to remember, until the confirmation, which I think they just announced 2 days ago, was scheduled on March the 2nd. So this is rolling through pretty quickly, and from everything that we've heard, it looks likely that he's going to get confirmed.
Yeah, got to believe he's going to. I mean, he has been a commissioner with the Federal Trade Commission. He had to get confirmation for that. I gotta imagine he's gonna be confirmed. So, yeah, that's something to watch out for. You know, just from what I'm hearing at the state level, that there's a couple of states that are ramping up with examinations, that they're kind of putting 2020 in the rear view mirror, and that they're doing examinations more remote than in the past, not as much on site, but that's something to keep an eye on.
Got to remember, this is they were tamed for a few years, but this is a workforce with 1,600 employees and a $600 million budget. So, Dave, I think it's Uejo, is the acting director right now, and he has. Ben has a history with the Bureau, and he has been ramping up hiring, getting ready for Chopra to take the reins. And they're kind of, made out of the same metal, can you say?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's that Warren and Cordray school of aggressive consumer advocacy. And, you know, look, we're preaching to the choir. You folks listening to this, you care about compliance. Can't imagine you're all on here just for the cocktails. You care about compliance. It's the folks that aren't listening to this, that have their head in the sand, that think it's just going to be business as usual. I am worried for those folks, because times are changing.
And so as things kind of go along here, and when we're talking things, obviously most of you know we're talking about the administration, the new administration. I think today is their 36th day in office, and they are trying to get as much done in their first 100 days as possible. And there's been a lot of movement this week on some of their nominations. I know CIA went through yesterday, and it looks like he's a likely He's actually on course right now to do a lot better than Obama did in terms of which the number of nominations he get approved. So, so it looks like there's not a lot stopping him. And that's just on the CFPB front. So, you know, which obviously, you know, fair lending, they keep talking about. That's one of Chopra's big...
it's going to be a hot-button issue.
Big topic, and if they go into it any way they did, like they did before, anything goes.
So for those of you listening, have a fair lending policy. Have some training on what fair lending means. You know, make sure that if any of your people had to have a one-minute conversation on the subject of fair lending, that they could have it. You know, I'm not asking for law school legal treaties. I'm asking for basic conversational skill of what fair lending is, where the law derives from, and what it means in your day-to-day business.
And if anybody, I mean, one of the things... You know, there's a saying about teaching to the test, and so when you know, sometimes we approach issues like how do you prepare yourself, right, for maybe some kind of, you know, regulatory investigation or a lawsuit. And one of the best ways for, let's say, the CFPB is to kind of go look at their examination books. They've got them online, and they've got sections on each area.
Oh yeah, there's a ton of
all the questions online. That they're going to if they came in and asked you, and those booklets literally are the templates for state attorney generals. Those are the booklets for plaintiff's attorneys. They're looking at these questions saying, oh, these are the questions that the CFPB would ask. And they spent years developing those under Cordray, but they're out there. If you need any, you know where to go. Go to Ignite's website and just give us a call. We'll be happy to send you a link to those documents, but they're out there on the CFPB's website.
And by the way, y'all don't take advantage of that offer enough. You could reach out to us anytime, info@ignitecp.com. Ask us questions. You don't have to be a client. We will gladly put you in the right direction and give you some pointers.
We have a nickname. We call those drive-bys. So those are just the random questions we get periodically, and we love to help. So
periodically.
Yeah, okay, every day. A couple times a day. We get quick little questions where I already know the link. I know where it is. So we'll save you the time. Just give us a call. Send us an email, and we'll be happy to help you out. So that's the CFPB. I know we've got the executive branch. That's kind of some folks' concern that are probably listening to this, you know, that are actually, you know, in the category where they're regulated by the CFPB. But the states are going to follow suit, so it's definitely something that we all need to keep our eyes on. Those trends do tend to trickle down from the federal government, and they've got pretty much 2 years, mostly unimpeded, to kind of get pushed through what they want to push through. So
here's a pointer, and I just got off the phone. Having this conversation with somebody, that they were asking what could they do to protect themselves. And I said, let me ask you, how good is your complaint management? And quite frankly, they gave me a really weak answer. And I think that is something that everybody needs to double down on. Train your people on complaint management. Train them how to respond to complaints, how to talk to customers. I just reviewed a demand letter that a client got. A draft of a lawsuit was attached in it, and it should have never reached that point if they just practiced a little bit of complaint management and how to recognize garbage issues and real issues and distinguish between them and take care of things when they need to. So I'll get off the soapbox on that, but I think that's a big one.
So Congress, let's talk a little bit about that. I know you've got a pretty divided Senate, one vote majority, assuming everyone votes party line, which it already has shown not to happen, which is gives some consolation to some folks. You see folks like Joe Manchin.
Yeah, but let's talk about the House, because that's more interesting.
Maxine Waters.
Scary. The name scares me.
Yeah.
I shivered when he said it.
Yeah. I mean, she's already calling. There's things like the GameStop deal. She wants to have a bunch of hearings on them. If you don't follow her, which I do, especially with regards to FCRA, she's got several bills that she's proposed, and I'm going to guarantee you they're going to come back up there.
Okay, so here's my question. Going to impact credit reporting. You mentioned FCRA. Does she want to nationalize the credit reporting agencies, or maybe nationalize is the wrong word, but she basically wants to come up with like a federal credit reporting agency?
No, what essentially she wants to do is put in more protections for consumers, essentially.
Yeah, but you could do that by law, you could do that by regulation, you could do that in the existing framework, but what I've been reading is that the CFPB possibly is looking into having some sort of version of their own.
And they can do that as a regulatory agency, right? They can do that through rulemaking.
I think they could. Now it makes me wonder, where does that leave TransUnion and Experian and everybody else? But, you know, I think there's a lot of game left to be played there, but it scares the heck out of me because this is already a ton of liability. It's still the number one lawsuit being brought against creditors. And if the government gets more involved, I mean, call me a cynic, but anytime the government gets more involved, I don't think it makes things easier for business.
No, and you remember even, you know, in December, Maxine Waters was pushing Biden to rescind the debt collection rule. And, you know, I don't think she thought the new rules went far enough. And so she wanted additional rules added, but she is just very much on the side of the consumer. You know, I don't want to be pejorative about a person, but she the bill that passed the House in the last Congress, if you look at it, I think it was 5332, with regards to credit reporting was pretty darn restrictive. Right, and so we anticipate them attempting to push something like that through. So there may be a modified version that makes it through committee and gets through the Senate. So we're definitely keeping our eye on that. Again, this is something where we talk about getting your house in order now. Like, don't wait for the major change. You know, don't wait for the monster to be at your door. You know what I mean? Go ahead and put the locks on the door. Put the locks on the window. Get everything prepared. Do everything you're supposed to be doing. Get your house in order.
So what does that mean? I mean, you know, to us, the first thing it means is don't just assume that your reporting is happening correctly. Pull a couple of files a month and look and do a little mini audit and then write down your findings. I mean, Richard, you could probably talk more about that than me, but you know, just give them some pointers on what they should be doing.
Mini audit. In fact, I just saw a report a few days ago that kind of showed the cumulative data from 2019 to 2020. Do you know FCRA complaints didn't go up 10%. They didn't go up 20%. They doubled.
Wow.
Between 2019 and the pandemic. And a lot of it is a pandemic, and a lot of folks had obviously had some credit issues during that time period and still have credit issues. So this looks like, and you know, their economy's still recovering. People are still having issues paying their bills. So this is not an issue that's going away. Right. And so because of that, this is probably going to be a popular issue for them to legislate on. Right. If you're trying to, you know, win votes and, you know, you're going to want to support some kind of legislation that helps people that have been impacted by a natural disaster. So it just makes sense that this is something's coming down the path with regards to credit reporting. So definitely something you want to keep in mind. Steve, you got anything else on that?
Yeah, I got
our friend Maxine.
I got this great cease and desist letter to talk about. Should we talk about it now, or you want to talk about it after we finish?
No, we can jump right into this. And I always want to mention this. You know, haven't quite come up with a name for it, but horror stories are of the week or of the month. But every week we are required by federal, state, and local law to share stories from the trenches. And the lessons that you can learn from them. So we've removed the names to protect the innocent. And so Steve's got a credit dispute here.
I laughed my ass off.
There's more than we can count of these. We see them all the time. They get.
We see these all the time, but this may be the greatest credit dispute I've ever read. I mean, I'm thinking about framing this and hanging it in my office. So I'm going to read a little bit because it's just so darn good. And when you hear me yelling a little bit, that's because it's in all caps. And there's a lot of all caps here. So this is a 5-page letter. The first 2 pages are a bunch of gobbledygook. I couldn't really make out what it's trying to accomplish. I think it's supposed to get everybody to throw it out and think it's just nonsense, gobbledygook garbage. But then on page 3, it gets interesting. So it starts off page 3. Even before we begin, take clear notice that I am an educated and learned student of reporting standards concerning my consumer and also my civil rights. Litigation is not my enemy, but my ally. Actually, it's Allie, Alli, but we'll give her the ally. If you are confused as to the legal ramifications of being deficient of not only compliance, but proven compliance, as well much less true, accurate, and complete reporting, I suggest you consult immediately with your legal counsel prior to your erroneous decision to counter me, minus adequate documentation of every single one in each and every in all aspects, notations, fragments, allegations accused of me, as you have currently reported illegally, all caps. And then, buried in with that, in small letters, because she doesn't want to call attention to this letter is your formal notice to cease and desist all collection activities in regard to the above complaint. This is a credit dispute. So hidden in with all that, and again, I think the goal is to have everybody throw it out before they ever read that, is formal notice that this is a dispute and you better cease and desist. So then it goes on. I mean, it gets better. It gets better. Mm-hmm. My next letter will be notification of my Lloyd's notice. And I didn't know what a Lloyd's notice was. I had to look it up. So you not need for a legal dictionary. A Lloyd's notice is a letter of intent to sue. To be clear and frank, you best be proven compliant to all requirements and standards of FCRA compliance and also the implemented CRSA enacted CDIA implemented Metro 2 compliance mandates as well.
I don't know where they find this stuff, Steve. It's like they literally go out on the internet, they Google credit dispute, and they just copy and paste from wherever.
I will demand verification that each employee at your firm, which might have seen or conducted any business on the file you allege mine, has been trained properly by a certified and qualified instructor of the Metro 2 data field formatting reporting standards. I mean, that's like trying to create an obligation that doesn't exist by law.
My favorite ones are where they're sending the letters to the first party creditors and they keep referencing the FDCPA and they're collecting under their own name, they originated the note. These are oftentimes companies that don't even have a related finance company. And again, clearly whoever sends it, and the worst is when I really have a good suspicion that it actually comes from one of these law firms, mm-hmm. one of these, and I read it and I'm thinking, an attorney put this together? But it can sound really confusing.
And I think they do it to kind of just confuse people. So it goes on. I am not shy in detailing my doubts. You can withstand the requisites to survive a court hearing versus me as I leverage your deficiencies for a slew of victories being awarded a minimum of $1,000 per violation per time. And there certainly appear to be buckets full. So let's do this. And then it threatens criminal prosecution, talks about chicanery and subterfuge. And then it says, I'm positive I could convince a court of your liabilities to me, capital letters, what say you? You know, it reminds me, I used to have a client, he would close every letter with, please govern yourself accordingly in capital letters. So we laugh, and we're poking fun of this, but it's really a serious problem because I think just about 90-whatever percent of companies that would have got that letter wouldn't have known what to do with it, would have thrown it out, and would have missed that there is a dispute in there.
Because there are requirements when you receive a letter like this that have multiple demands within the same letter. And I think that's correct. What trips people up is because you have the definitely dispute requirements to
and
furniture
there was a cease and desist.
Under the FCRA, but then also sometimes they request additional documentation.
Right.
Under Dodd-Frank, they have the right to ask for certain documents related to their contract, right? They can ask for the retail installment contract, anything that isn't proprietary to like a scoring model or something that they signed in their deal jacket, they have a right to, or a lot of things, not everything. This is the reason we bring this up is because it's almost like they're gaming it. These letters, they're sending them out in mass, and they're almost gaming them. And so it's something that we, definitely we're on the lookout. I mean, I've had literally a two-page letter like that before, and I've spent 3 hours researching it because of the different claims made within it to just try to break out, okay, what are they asking here? What are they asking here? Because there's no law that says you can't have a FCRA dispute and also some other things in the same letter, right? So,
and you talk about investigation, and I got news for you folks. An adequate investigation is not hitting the button on your system and confirming that the system is generating a letter on your screen that's the same number that appears on what you reported. Of course it is. The number being reported is from your system. That is not an adequate investigation, and if that's what you want to go to court on, you're going to have a long day. You've got to really understand the issues and undertake an investigation of whatever the heart of the claims are. I really encourage everybody. Richard is a wonderful resource. He could train your people in an hour or two and give them so much knowledge. So reach out to him and let him do that. At our conference in May, he's putting on a half-day workshop just on this issue because we think it's such a big issue. In Dallas, Fort Worth, where we are, and other parts of the country, this is such a hotly litigated issue, and those cases are very difficult to settle because the lawyers are just playing with house money at that point. They're going to gamble and figure, for every one of these I bring, I'm going to find somebody that doesn't know what they're doing and I'm going
to
nail them.
I think the key with regards to credit reporting, too, is reasonable investigation because that's the way the law is written is what's your furniture obligation. You have to do a reasonable investigation. And, of course, thankfully, Congress didn't define that in the law because that's the way a lot of laws are written, and we just kind of have to muddle along and hope there's some case law. And there's not a lot. There was an 11th Circuit case in 2016, I think, that talked about or discussed a little bit about what a reasonable investigation was. And essentially, it's just that you had to investigate. As part of your investigation, you had to look at all relevant documentation related to what was in dispute, right?
And a lot of times, that just means reading what the customer is asking, and then give them a copy of the contract, give them a copy of the credit application, and you're proving up the validity of the account. Now, then if they want to claim identity theft or something else, that's a whole different story. But that's not always set forth.
And just to make it clear as mud, like that, some of the case law, the verbiage is literally like, what's reasonable? What's a reasonable investigation? Oh, it'll vary depending on the circumstances of the case, whether the case is being investigated by the CRA or by the data furnisher, which is probably most of our listeners. I don't know if we have any CRA listeners. If you're here, credit reporting agencies, welcome. But then it varies depending on the circumstances.
Hey, if we have any plaintiff's lawyers listening, get off now. You're not authorized.
So the reasonableness from the case law really is dependent upon the facts of the particular case. And so everyone is different. So don't cheat your investigations. Do a good job. Don't rush them through. What's that, Steve? Where they were doing with the mortgage things? When they were
the robo signing. Or I forget, it was one of the first CFPB actions, and I'm not going to guess at the name because I'm not sure of it. But basically, when they did the math, that the company had two employees working on all of the disputes, and they got like 20 something thousand disputes in a year. And if you did the math, they were like doing a dispute every 8 minutes, and that didn't account for smoke breaks, bathroom breaks, lunch breaks, whatever else. It was just like, okay, if they did this every moment they were at work for the entire year, they still wouldn't get through the whole list. So you have to be adequately staffed, you have to have your people adequately trained. That conversation is different depending on your size, depending on how many you get. You know, again, if you just want to talk in general with us about what you're doing and what you could be doing better, give us a holler. So that was my horror story of the week. Richard, you got a horror story this week?
I've had a couple of those this week with credit disputes, but I know you and I spoke earlier a little bit about this side issue where there was a warranty issue and an extended service contract. So explain that a little bit.
Yeah, okay, so this one's interesting, and I have seen this happen from time to time. So the dealer provides a limited warranty, and the dealer also sells an extended service contract.
The limited warranty that's on the buyer's guide, right?
Correct.
Okay.
It's a limited warranty. You know, in this case, it was a 30-day, 1,000-mile, 3,000-mile, whatever it was, a limited warranty, but they also sold a service contract. And the question came up, customer comes in and had an issue, and the limited warranty says that we'll split everything with you 50-50. You know, if we do a repair, labor, whatever, it's 50-50. The extended service contract doesn't have that limitation.
And they both had the same start date as the date of sale?
They both had the same start date, and the customer's ticked off for a couple of reasons that I won't get into, but the question becomes, so wait a second. Are you charging the customer for any of these items under the limited warranty? Because if you are, I've got a question as to why, because you've got an extended service contract that says all that's covered. So, you know,
So this is a big issue that we deal with a lot in when we look at deal jackets, and this is one where you literally have two scenarios that are in conflict. This is a common one. The most common one is where we see competing arbitration clauses,
yep,
right?
Yep.
And so we mentioned that. This came up yesterday or
yep.
today? Yesterday. We mentioned it just because if those kinds of issues go to court and a plaintiff's attorney can provide two different documents to show that there is competing. It's not
confusion.
They're not even going to go with the one that best helps the customer necessarily. Like in the case of arbitration, they'll just throw it out and say the customer can go to court.
They're just going to say it's deceptive. They're going to say it's misleading. That they're going to try to paint the dealer as a bad guy. And look, I'm not trying to simplify this issue. There's a lot of detail here. What's excluded? Are there exclusions in one that are covered by the other? I mean,
they don't necessarily compete, but they can.
And they don't have to synchronize. But my point is, your people have to understand what your products mean and say, and try to be fair to the customer and not just assume dealer's always right.
So the lesson from this horror story is, if you haven't looked at your deal jacket, pull it up.
Mm-hmm.
We see retail installment contracts with an arbitration agreement built in, and we see a separate arbitration agreement all the time.
I looked at one the other day that had a buyer's guide that talked about a limited warranty, and then I looked at the limited warranty document itself, and it seemed to contradict the buyer's guide. And of course, when I pulled on that thread and I asked the dealer principal and I asked the general manager, nobody knows when the changes were made or why they were made. And, you know, everybody wanted to blame the last guy that was there. This stuff happens all the time. So, you know, it's your businesses. You want to protect your business. You're responsible for your business. So make sure you're buttoned up when it comes to your documents. You're only as good as your documents.
Yeah, and just at least for the next 2 years, okay, everybody just needs to buckle in.
Oh,
right?
Heck, I'd say that forever.
I mean, I'd say forever, but as you and I know, there has been
next couple of years will be worse.
There has been an increase in attention based on the number of calls that we've received in compliance-related issues in consumer finance, specifically Buy Your Pay Here, finance companies, and for good reason, right? I think a lot of folks felt, you know, they were skating through, and then...
Oh, we've had some folks admit that you know, that they just weren't motivated, and they diverted assets elsewhere, and they took headcount and put them elsewhere, and, You know, now we're actually working with several folks training new compliance people right now, because dealers had to put them, you know, back in that position, and that's one of my favorite things about my job is training new compliance people, because I don't know, I find it really rewarding that they get to learn the business and they kind of get to see it through our eyes. So I think that's pretty neat.
That's great. And that's, I mean, it just, it's time to look at it. If you haven't, it's time to at least step back and start asking some questions. You know, email us at info@ignitecp.com if you have a question. info@ignitecharliepaul.com. We can send you a checklist so you can at least sit down and ask the right questions. You know, we'll just send it to you. We'll be happy to. And then if you have questions, if you're not doing any of the, or some of the things that are on that checklist, then you can reach back out to us and maybe we can help you come up with a game plan, right?
Yep.
So,
hey, so it's almost month end, so I'm going to tell my favorite month end story. So I was in-house at a pretty decent sized finance company, and they had never had a lawyer before, and that there was like this natural tension between me and some of the managers, especially the collection manager. And collection manager didn't want me to train the collectors and didn't want me to talk about things like calling third parties and right party contacts and leaving messages and stuff. And it was just this tension. So I'm like, okay, how am I going to get this guy to work with me? So what I would do, and it only took like 2 months, at the end of the month, I'd go walk the collection floor. And first time he comes running out, he's like, what are you doing here? I'm just listening. You know, it's month end. I want to make sure that everything's compliant. I'm just listening. Second month I did that, he pulls me in his office. He's like, what's it going to take to work with me? I'm like, well, I'll tell you what. If you let me train your people and let me do my courses and you let me work with some of your collectors, I don't necessarily have to walk the floor the last day of the month. I could walk the floor the last week of the month. Or the middle of the month. So, and that's one of my favorite stories because, you know, as a compliance person, you should be just as good at the end of the month as you are any other time. And I know a lot of people cut corners and they want to move at the speed of business and they want to get that last day a deal in before the end of the month. But you always got to remember, nobody's going to care about that if it winds up in legal. So just try to do things the right way. Try to make compliance a 24/7 job. And with that,
I think we're done with this podcast. We'll be resuming.
Let's mention our conference
next. I was gonna say we need to talk about our conference compliance unleashed 2021. We put a pause button on 2020. Obviously, last May was a tough time to do an in-person conference. But we are back, and we are doing an in-person conference here in DFW.
May 17th to 19th, yep. Right by DFW Airport. We know compliance is a lot of work, but we make compliance fun. We feed you well. We have an open bar. We've got some great events. We got an amazing cast of presenters that we're bringing in that are really going to help you fine-tune your compliance efforts, protect your business.
Yeah, I mean, we Brent Carmichael.
Dave Brotherton. We've got Bill Metzinger, who's a dealer in Pennsylvania that has some great things to say about social media. We have such a full slate of speakers.
Sean Peterson
there talking about IDA now of Buckeye.
I mean, it is a stacked conference in terms of the talent, the knowledge, experience, and you know, the expertise. Folks that have been dealing with compliance issues for decades, and they are literally leaders of the industry, and they gratefully agreed to help us because they see the value.
So check us out
in compliance. So check us out, ignitecp.com.
Yep, Richard's going to be signing autographs.
I am not Ollie North in Washington D.C. last year. That was at the NIDA thing. We were fortunate enough to meet with him, and I got a signature for Steve on a book. But I won't be signing signatures, but we will be having tons of partying. So Monday we're having a big reception at the hotel. Tuesday we're planning on going to the Cowboys Golf Club. We're going to bus everybody out there. Open bars. Tons of fun. Live music. We're just going to have fun.
And compliance.
So, yeah. So we think compliance should be fun. It is fun, we think.
Because we're nerds.
But we'll make it fun for you. It will be just chock full of information, actionable items you'll be able to take back. We're not some philosophical legal lecture that just leaves your head swimming. You'll actually go away with the checklist in all these different areas of what you can do to help make your business better at compliance.
So with that, we are going to call it a wrap on this podcast, and we will be back probably next week, maybe the week after, and we'll do another one. So thanks, everybody, for listening, and cheers.
Thanks. It's been great. Cheers, and don't forget, keep your eyes out for the next Ken Compliance Cocktails. We'll be here, and we look forward to seeing you again.